This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 3rd of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. I'm joined today by writer Mark Mason to discuss three books he's chosen for us. On our bookshelf today, we have a sweeping historical account of a cabin in Germany, The House by the Lake by Thomas Harding. We also look at the life of Winnie the Pooh creator Ernest Howard Shepherd in a new biography by James Campbell. And we'll conclude our review with A Monstrous Commotion, The Mysteries of Loch Ness by Scottish academic Gareth Williams. That's all to come here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Mark. We're going to start with The House by the Lake, a non-fiction work by Thomas Harding that charts the history of a single wood cabin in the countryside near Berlin. The narrative covers two world wars, the dividing of a nation and its eventual reunification. But we should start, I guess, Mark, by saying that the author, Harding, he has a personal stake in this story, doesn't he?
He does. The house in question, The House by the Lake, is his great-grandmother's house. His great-grandfather, right? His grandmother took him there in the early 1990s, and by that point she was 80. And her parents had built it. They were called the Alexanders. And they'd built it out. It's outside Berlin. It's the equivalent of having a country house out in Surrey when you live in London, or the Hamptons when you live in Manhattan or whatever. And they built it in the 1930s. And it's then the story, the book, tells the story of all the families that lived in it over the subsequent decades. Until she took him back there, and by the time the story comes up to date, the house has become derelict, and the end of the story is the author trying to go back to save it. So it's a way of looking at post-war German history, with Soviet occupation and the Second World War and the Jews and the problems they faced in the 1930s, told through a house. It's a really unusual method of telling history, to take an inanimate object and look at all the families that sit there. And it's fascinating. I think it's a brilliant concept, and he's brought it off fantastically.
I mean, the subtitle of the book is A Story of Germany, and he does manage to pull that off. It is, as you say, an interesting device. Do you think you get more out of a book like this? I mean, it's obviously well-trodden ground, the history of Germany in the 20th century. Do you think using this device gives you something extra?
Absolutely. It makes the house come to life. It sounds a really silly thing to do, almost as though you're talking about a kid's film with a house that, you know, an inanimate object coming to life. But he does it brilliantly. The talking of how the house was built back in the early 1930s. Dr. Alexander was a doctor, very well-to-do, could afford to build this house. And the beautiful, as ever, the details are what make a great story. And it's the same here. He put some tiles, 5 rows of 6 blue and white tiles above the fireplace. And then as it goes on, various families that live there that don't treat the house so well. And then in the Soviet occupation era in the 1950s and 60s, one of the families that's living there is so poor because of what the Soviets have done to Eastern Europe, that he has to, one of the owners, wallpapers over the fireplace to try and keep a tiny bit of the draft out. So wallpapers over the tiles. And then later on, someone who's living there, who ironically isn't trying to bring the house back to life, he's a complete drunkard, just one day rips the wallpaper off for something to do and reveals the tiles again. And you almost feel as though this is a house. This house is almost like a pet. I kept having this image of like a family dog that's been passed around various families and how they've taken care of it or not. And it really makes you, it brings all the families to life, but it also brings this house to life. And is a really moving story.
Can you take us through some of the families? So we obviously start with the great-grandparents of the author, Thomas Harding. Where does it go from there?
Have to leave Germany because of the Nazis. They're a Jewish family, as I say. And then as the 1930s progress and it becomes increasingly clear what Hitler's up to, at one point, Dr. Alexander's over in London and his wife and his daughter Elsie, who is the author's grandmother, basically contact him in London and say, stay over there and we're leaving as well. We've got to get out. And they then rent the house to a second family. And while that second family is in occupation of the house, the Nazis basically just take the house off the original owners, the Alexanders. They say, you're Jewish, you're not allowed to own property. And they take them. And then the state sells it to that second family, which then later on, at the very end of the book, the second family is called the Meisels. So they own the house at that point. Then later on in the early 2000s, in fact, the Meisel descendants bring a a lawsuit against the government because they want to get their house back. And by that point, it's passed through so many owners, it's hard to tell. And eventually the judgment comes back that they can't have it back because it was stolen by the Nazis and sold like that. It's almost as the modern judgment is you didn't own it in the first place. You shouldn't have, you know, owned it. The original deed of sale is at the bottom of it. The Meisels sign it, Heil Hitler. And so it brings it up to date with the house being derelict. Squatters are in it at one point. And then the author finishes off by saying, we're now trying to buy the house back or to get ownership of it to put up a museum. And, you know, a cultural centre and somewhere that the history of the place can be remembered.
Fantastic. The House by the Lake by Thomas Harding is out now, published by Random House. Let's move on now to Shepherd's War, E.H. Shepherd, the man who drew Winnie the Pooh, which is, as you might expect, a detailed biography of the illustrator of one of Britain's most loved fictional characters. James Campbell's work focuses on the artist's experience of the First World War, though, and even features some drawings he did from the front line. First off, Mark, what did you make of this work?
It's very intriguing to look at. It's going to be one of those books that's very difficult to talk about on the radio because normally with a non-fiction book, you talk about what's in it, as we just have and as we're going to talk about with the next book. But this one depends so much on the illustrations because E.H. Shepherd illustrated the Winnie the Pooh stories and also the original Wind in the Willows stories. And it's fascinating. In fact, as we as I arrived today, Fernando, who listeners will know from various other programmes, reminded me about Winnipeg, the original bear that Winnie the Pooh is based on. And I stupidly forgot I wasn't going to mention this. So thank you, Fernando. It's that Winnipeg was the bear that was taken by some Canadian soldiers on their way to fight in the First World War. And they'd stopped off in London and they realised they didn't want to take the bear actually to the battlefields. It just wouldn't make sense. So they left it in London Zoo and the bear ended up staying there. And that's the bear that A.A. Milne and his son saw. And that's where they got the idea for Winnie the Pooh. That's where they got the name for Winnie the Pooh. Winnie Peg, the real bear, was a female, but of course Winnie the Pooh is male in the stories.
Yeah.
And then, so it's funny to have that thought in our heads as we read this story about E.H. Shepherd, who illustrated the original Winnie the Pooh stories, and his service during the First World War. He goes to fight and does lots of cartoons of his colleagues, of his superiors in the army, in the trenches. So a lot of it is very humorous. He does some humorous, you know, an affectionate one of a captain in the army, and Shepherd draws him as a conductor of a very motley band of musicians who are all around him. So it's poking fun, but affectionately. And then also he does a series of cartoons about German stereotypes. And again, I promise you, this, as I wrote this down, I looked at my notes. This doesn't quite have the effect that it does when you look at the book. But the cartoons, we're all familiar with those drawings, the Winnie the Pooh drawings. So imagine someone in that style drawing as well as he does. Shepherd draws various Germans and does them as the 12 days of Christmas. For instance, one omnipotent Oberburgomeister overflowing Ostend. And lots of funny little, I promise you they are funny. The cartoons are brilliant. Also, some of the pictures are more serious because he also had his watercolours with him. Most of them are pencil drawings. But he had his watercolours with him. And there's one particular one of shells exploding on the battlefield. And it's done in quite a abstract way. It's not, there aren't any horrors in there. You don't see any people being blown apart in the book. But you get the sense of just the confusion and the chaos and the utter carnage that there was without actually, as I say, there being blood. It really is quite powerful, some of them.
And there are kind of over 100 illustrations in this book. Do you get a sense through them of the man? I mean, obviously you've said he's humorous. He has a humorous side, but he also has a dark side. Do we see? Tell us a little bit about the man himself and what we find out in this.
You do. Book. You get. Well, he keeps the dark side, not so much of himself, but of the war. He keeps the dark side hidden from his relatives. There's text in the book as well where the author explains what Shepherd was going through at various points. For instance, his elder brother, Cyril Shepherd, was killed on the first day of the Somme. And Shepherd didn't know that his brother had been killed until he got a letter from his sister at home back in the UK telling him what had happened. And by that point, Shepherd was near the place that his brother Cyril had died and he could manage to go and find the grave. So it shows that's such an absurd thing that you are in the same country, just a few miles from where your brother's killed, but you don't know about it because a letter's gone home to tell the sister that he's been killed, and she's written back to him. So again, it's a bit like comedy and drama being both two sides of the same coin, or comedy and tragedy. You definitely get that with this. Shepherd tries to keep a lot of that from his family. He apparently several times narrowly avoided either serious injury or death, but in his letters home, some of which are in the book, he just doesn't mention it because he doesn't want his family, you know, being any more scared than they have to be.
Right. I mean, James Campbell, who actually runs the Shepherd Trust, and he's the author of this, he has access to some kind of works that haven't actually been published before now. Do you think this could lead to a kind of reappraisal of Shepherd as a man and an artist as well?
I don't know about a reappraisal. I mean, he comes out, you just associate, you instantly want to like him because he drew your favourite illustrations of your childhood, Winnie the Pooh. He's a cute, and he comes out of it as a really good guy. As I say, he's trying to keep his family as happy as he can. Comes out, the text paints him as a very likeable guy. I don't think it's reappraisal. I think it's just a reminder that even people who are associated with fluffy stuff like that, if for want of a better adjective, have been through less fluffy things in their life. And in a way, it makes you admire him all the more that he can produce work like that in a scenario like that.
And I guess it's also quite interesting. I mean, we were saying earlier that looking at the history of Germany in the 20th century through a house and looking at the First World War through a kind of a humorous illustrator.
Yeah.
They're kind of, you know, interesting sideways glances of serious, serious history.
Absolutely. And he does bring the two things together, actually. With some of the drawings are technically accurate drawings of the guns and the howitzers and various military equipment. I don't think he was doing those as design drawings. He wasn't involved in the design stage. He was just, I think he wanted to keep his hand in. I mean, I guess a lot of life in the trenches was boredom. It was waiting for the push over the top, and you were there with not very much to do. And if all it produced was this, then it's worth it from his point of view, I guess, you know.
That was Shepherd's War, E.H. Shepherd, The Man Who Drew Winnie the Pooh, by James Campbell, and that's out now, published by Michael O'Mara. Mark, your final choice on today's book review is A Monstrous Commotion, The Mysteries of Loch Ness, a new work examining the tale of the Loch Ness Monster. Now, Mark, Gareth Williams, who's the author of this, is definitely on very well-trodden ground here. How can he possibly reveal anything new in this account? That was my kind of first thought about this.
Yeah, good. I mean, unless you were... that's a good question, I was going to say. But unless you were as obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster as some of the people in this book, you would never have had all that material gathered together in one place. It reminded me very much of a book we did a couple of years ago on the programme about the Great Train Robbery in 1964, 63, the Great Train Robbery. And it was the 50th anniversary of that. And so they used that anniversary to bring together all the theories about the robbery that there'd ever been. And this is very much the same with the Loch Ness Monster. Brings together everyone who's ever looked for it, including Nicholas Witchell, who BBC viewers will know as the royal correspondent at the moment, the man that Prince Charles famously said he couldn't stand. There was a very famous press conference a few years ago. Witchell, as a student in the early 70s, got obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster and used to go up there and look for it. So it's really interesting, you know, all those little people that come out of the woodwork that you wouldn't associate with it. But, I mean, a lot of the value of the book is just the sheer comedy. The very sort of person that's going to be interested in the Loch Ness Monster in the first place is going to give you some great comic material. There's Wing Commander Basil Carey and his wife Winifred, known as Freddie, and she works out which pub her husband is in. They live near the loch. And she works out which pub her husband is in by dangling a pendulum over a map. She claims she can divine which pub he's in. Apparently it always works. And then she rings up the pub and goes, send him home. And there was a big Friends in the 1930s. The Daily Mail in 1933 sent one of their reporters up who was trying to tempt the Loch Ness Monster out of the loch with a leg of mutton, which someone locally said, that's not going to do it. We should do it with six bullocks impaled on appropriately sized hooks. And then there's a guy who turns up who's convinced that the reason the monster's never spotted is that the monster can telepathically tell when people are looking at the loch, looking for it. So he tries to trick it by walking away from the loch and then quickly turning round. It's the comedy of this book is just fantastic.
I mean, it sounds like there's an amazing cast of characters here that he kind of investigates. I mean, do you get a sense through the book that Williams, he truly believes it, or is he doing it purely to kind of, is it poking fun at these people?
Well, do you know what? It doesn't do that too much. I mean, it would be really easy just to do a complete hatchet job on these people. You know, he hangs them by their own petards, as it were. He just reports what they do, and that in itself is so ridiculous that they do his job for him. But he also very calmly and rationally goes through the various possibilities. For instance, there's light refraction, wave formations. If you get two waves running into each other at an angle from a distance, and Loch Ness is huge as well, as a lot of the sightings are over huge distances, that can look incredibly like something sticking out of the water. There's also lumps of vegetation which have been rotting on the surface of the on the bottom of the lake, and they're brought to the surface by the gases of their own decomposition. So he very calmly tells you what the explanations could be. But underneath it all, I think there is a more serious point here. It's about the nature of obsession. Another book it kept reminding me of was Selling Hitler, which was Robert Harris, before he started writing historical novels, was a non-fiction writer. And he wrote a book about the faking of the Hitler diaries in 1983. And all the way through that, he makes the point that people believed in that because they wanted to believe. And there must be something missing in their life that they get obsessed with this thing. It's the same with the monster. A lot of it's very, very sad. It's right at the end of the book, he mentions Steve Feltham, who is now in the 24th year of his vigil by the lake looking for the monster. And he lives in a mobile library van, which is no longer mobile. It's rusted into place by the side of the lake. But it's got a stove that in winter provides nearly enough heat, as Williams puts it. And Feltham, as he interviews this guy, and Feltham's eyes are just constantly looking back at the water. He's obviously obsessed. And the really sad thing is he came there at the age of 28. He abandoned all his family connections and a safe job down in Dorset because he, quote, didn't want to reach the age of 70, only to look back on a life unfulfilled. And it's haunting. There's obviously something missing. I don't know what happened with that guy and his family, what the history was, why he fell out with them, why he moved up there. It's like people who get obsessed with Elvis Presley or with World War II or guns. Or, you know, there is something, whatever you latch onto, there is something missing in you in the first place. So it's a really interesting study of that side of human nature.
Right, and also it's quite interesting because we're quite obsessed with reading about people who are obsessed with other things. Yeah. It's kind of fascinating that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And finally, there's just one last question I thought. Do you think it's fact or fable? Does this convince you in any way at all?
I'm pretty convinced. I mean, like I say, there's one section at the end where he runs through the various possibilities. And a lot of it's very surprising that you get the optical illusions that things that light can play on you. And that water can play on you, as I say, when the waves running into each other. Yeah, it was really, I'm absolutely convinced there's nothing down there. But it's not a book about the Loch Ness Monster. It's about the people who are looking for the Loch Ness Monster.
Absolutely. A Monstrous Commotion, The Mysteries of Loch Ness by Gareth Williams is out now and it's published by Orion Books. And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of today's show. Mark Mason, thank you very much for joining us today. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for this week's film review. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.